A new study looks at pregnant women living near hydraulic fracturing.
It's very consistent that women living closer to more and larger wells appear to be at an elevated risk of developing anxiety and depression.
The study looked at over 7,000 women living in Pennsylvania. I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we also have a story about a longtime researcher of mussel populations and her frustrations.
What's in this water that's causing them to die? We need to wake up and pay attention to what's out there.
And purple martins are birds that eat lots of insects each year and need our help to survive.
People are the only thing standing between this species and their extinction in the eastern part of their range.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A new study shows that pregnant women living near hydraulic fracking activity are more likely to develop depression and anxiety. Researchers at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health conducted the study in Pennsylvania, which included more than 7,700 expected mothers. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden spoke with Joan A. Casey, an environmental health scientist and the study's lead author. Casey says a growing body of research shows elevated levels of air pollution contribute to anxiety and depression.
There's also, I think, a high likelihood of a stress pathway. So there have been several sociologic and qualitative studies done in communities with high levels of fracking, and people report stress, anxiety, they report concerns about changes of the environmental quality of their communities. They report a lack of control about their environment. Mothers have reported feeling like they can't keep their children safe under this new development. So I think it's also very possible that the stress of these activities going on in mothers' communities could potentially be leading to antenatal depression and anxiety.
You know, in science, they talk a lot about correlation does not equal causation. So are you sure that this isn't just a correlation? Are you sure that there's a relationship between more mental health conditions in pregnant women and fracking?
We can't say we're 100% sure that these women are developing anxiety or depression during pregnancy as a result of living near unconventional natural gas development in the Marcellus Shale. But I don't have another explanation for what we're observing here. So we controlled for a variety of factors that might explain this relationship, factors about the mother, their smoking status, their socioeconomic status, how old they were, other factors of that sort. And it's very consistent that women living closer to more and larger wells appear to be at an elevated risk of developing anxiety and depression. We basically found that if we took 100 women and we exposed them to the higher levels of fracking activities during pregnancy, 4 of them would develop anxiety or depression that otherwise would not have developed it. So that's 4 additional people just for exposing 100 women to these fracking activities that we think can likely be attributed to the fracking activities.
While your study found a relationship between proximity to fracking and pregnant women experiencing depression and anxiety, it did not find that women who lived near these sites were more likely to give birth prematurely or have babies with low birth weights. So are these mental health issues that you documented that serious in the grand scheme of things?
What I would say there is two-pronged. First, I think that there's growing realization that we need to be concerned about the health of mothers during and after pregnancy. These are vulnerable women who are growing another human being inside of them, and their exposures potentially tell us something about what a larger population is experiencing, a somewhat canary in the coal mine effect here. Secondly, I would say that there is quite a bit of evidence that women who have anxiety or depression during pregnancy are at an elevated risk of postpartum depression. And we've all seen the literature on how postpartum depression can be very serious and can affect both the mother, the husband or father of the child, as well as the child's development. We also know from the scientific literature that women who have postpartum depression during pregnancy are at risk for having children that are developmentally delayed and potentially having more trouble breastfeeding or having other troubles during the postpartum period. So it's not just a one-off event here. It actually can affect health across the life course.
Joan, thanks for sharing your research with me today.
Thank you.
That was 90.5 WESA reporter Sarah Bowden speaking with Columbia University professor Joan A. Casey. She's lead author on a study about pregnant women and fracking, which was published in the journal Environmental Research. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Kara Holsapple. The biologically diverse waterways of the Ohio Valley are home to more than 100 species of freshwater mussels. Each can filter 5 to 10 gallons of water daily, but pollution, land use, and a changing climate threaten their existence. In recent years, many mussels have landed on the endangered species list. Reporter Brittany Patterson spent some time with a veteran biologist in West Virginia who reflects on her 3 decades of protecting mussels.
Janet Clayton is standing thigh deep in a back channel of the Elk River. Clad in a wetsuit and knee pads, the silver-haired biologist with the West Virginia Division of Natural Resources reaches into a bright orange mesh bag submerged in water. Inside are a half dozen mussels she plucked from the Rocky River bottom.
This is called a long solid. As it gets older, it gets really long.
Clayton holds an earthy-colored shell, about the size of a computer mouse, in the palm of her hand, and she easily identifies others.
This is a pocketbook, a wavy rayed lamp mussel, kidney shell.
Clayton, a West Virginia native, has studied mussels for about 3 decades. She began her career researching aquatic bugs, but quickly switched gears. Today, she heads West Virginia's mussel program, a program she helped build.
Mussels are very important to the environment.
In addition to filtering water, mussel excrement is a tasty meal for macroinvertebrates and benthic critters. Many mammals enjoy mussels, and they help keep our river bottoms in place. They're also sensitive.
Freshwater mussels are the most endangered group of animals in the country.
Tierra Curry is a Kentucky-based scientist with the Center for Biological Diversity, which advocates for federal protections for mussels and other threatened species. Good water quality is vital to the health of mussels, and humans have not always treated waterways with care. Chemical discharges, excess sediment, and dams all pose challenges to mussels.
So as we don't do a good enough job taking care of our rivers and streams, the freshwater mussels are on the front lines of paying the price for that.
Today, scientists know a lot more about freshwater mussels and how to protect them. And a lot of that, Curry says, has to do with Janet Clayton.
Janet Clayton is a total hero for freshwater mussels.
Working with partners across the Ohio Valley, Clayton developed mussel surveying methods that have been widely adopted. Her team set up 26 long-term monitoring sites, like this one on the Elk River. On this day, 4 divers dropped their mussels at a holding table erected in the stream. Mussels tagged with little silver plastic stickers are measured. Then they're returned to the water. 5 years ago, Clayton and her team pulled hundreds of dead and dying Three Ridge mussels from this river. The cause remains a mystery.
I'm concerned. I'm majorly concerned.
Clayton is retiring next summer and says while in some ways the field has advanced, she fears some waterways will never again be healthy enough to support mussels. And new threats have emerged, like climate change and the growing natural gas industry.
Mussels live for decades in our streams, so they're like the canary in the coal mine. If mussels are dying, which in this case they are, what's in this water that's causing them to die? We need to wake up and pay attention to what's out there.
For now, Clayton is taking every opportunity to spend time in the water, her preferred office. And she says she plans to stick around to train her successor. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson in the Elk River, West Virginia.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. For more stories about wildlife and conservation, head to AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. Rising global temperatures and a changing climate are creating economic hardships in some parts of the world and growing violence.
He was a farmer, and they just stole what he had on him and killed him. All of this leads people to crime, I don't know, as a way to make easy money.
Coming up on the Allegheny Front, a look at the impacts of drought, violence, and climate change on human migration. Stay tuned. The purple martin, a bird that's known for its chattering song and aerial acrobatics, lives in colonies, but it relies on human-made nest boxes to breed in the eastern U.S. The population in Pennsylvania has dropped by nearly two-thirds over the last 50 years. But the Purple Martin Conservation Association, an international group based in Erie, is working to save the species. The Allegheny Front summer intern, Jack Austin, caught up with Joe Segrist, their president and CEO. He was checking on one of the colonies at Presque Isle.
So we're going to be lowering down the house. It's on a winch and cable system on the aluminum pole that it's mounted on. And that's an important feature of any purple martin housing, that it be able to be lowered so you can keep aware of any conditions that may arise in the nest if you have predators. It's helpful in keeping the invasive species out. You can lower the housing down and remove it.
Wow, that is low.
Oh yeah, yeah, we bring it all the way down. As you can see, we can lower the housing down and get hands on the birds here. Let me grab one of these. So these are just about old enough to fly. You can see the leg bands that we put on them. Yeah, they're pretty easy going, but are able to fly because there they go.
Purple martins in the area have faced loss of habitat. What are the main sources of that loss?
Purple martins are suffering from a lack of nesting habitat. Traditionally, they would have nested in secondary cavities, which are woodpecker holes and holes in rock piles and cliffs and that sort of thing. So over time, we have fewer forested areas, fewer standing dead trees to house those woodpecker holes. And one of the major factors is the introduction of two competing species from Europe, the English house sparrow and the European starling, who outcompete purple martins for the remaining cavities.
Purple martins almost exclusively breed in human-made birdhouses like this. Why is this?
It's really been a saving grace for them. The tradition of purple martins nesting in human-provided housing began before European settlement with Native Americans. They began hanging up hollowed-out gourds in their villages. We don't really know why, but purple martins began nesting in them, and this symbiotic relationship began at that point between humans and purple martins. And lucky for the martins, that mechanism was already in place for them as their natural habitat declined and those invasive species took over. They had this as kind of a fallback. Whereas a lot of species don't have that sort of a escape hatch when things start to get bad.
You mentioned that you teach members how they can set up their own martin colonies. So I was wondering if people need a special background, or you could just tell me how that process works.
It's surprisingly easy. A lot of folks mistakenly think that you need to have a pond right near where you put up purple martin housing. That's really not the case. They get a lot of the water that they need from the food that they eat. And they also travel miles and miles every day in their search of food. So they'll find some water. You just need to provide the housing. And really the key is to have an open area. They don't like to be around tall trees because one of their major predators are hawks and owls, which use those trees as hiding places and easy access to the purple martin colony. So as long as you have an open area and you live in a part of the country that purple martins exist, you could put up purple martin housing.
So you sort of mentioned research earlier. What is the organization researching right now?
The most exciting one that we have going on right now is our migration research that regularly takes us down to Brazil to investigate the habitat that purple martins are using. Recent advances in technology called biologgers. Basically, they're little computer chips that have GPS on board and they record locations. In the last few years, we've been attaching these devices that weigh less than a gram to purple martins, and they migrate down south. And for the first time ever, we've been able to get an idea of where they are in Brazil, what type of habitat they're using, what they're encountering, to get a broader picture of all the things that are affecting purple martins, to see if some of the keys to that population decline are occurring away from the United States and Canada during the non-breeding season.
How has climate change affected purple martins?
They're one of the first birds back in the spring, and they're particularly vulnerable to late cold weather because they are aerial insectivores. They only eat flying insects. And if it's cooler than 50 degrees or so outside, there are no insects to be seen. So as the climate is changing, those spring and fall weather cycles are much more unstable and unpredictable. They may come back and freeze to death. They may come back and starve to death. You know, there's some really critical research that we're conducting to see if they're going to be able to be flexible enough in their timing to survive, particularly in the northern parts of the range as the climate is changing. Just give these birds a chance, because people are the only thing standing between this species that eats billions of insects every year and their extinction in the eastern part of their range.
That was Joe Segrist, president and CEO of Purple Martin Conservation Association, talking with the Allegheny Front's summer intern, Jack Austin. To find out if purple martins are in your area and what you need to build a purple martin house, go to AlleghenyFront.org. Global warming is increasingly jeopardizing food security on the planet. That's according to a new special UN report on climate change and land. According to an expert in one of the working groups which contributed to the report, 500 million people live in areas that are experiencing desertification, where fertile land becomes desert. The report suggests how we use land, whether we plant trees or raise crops in a way that reduces carbon emissions, could make a difference in how bad it gets. But for those who are already being impacted by climate change, hard choices are being made. They're thinking about ending careers, selling a house, and even leaving a country or a culture behind. That's what happened to two brothers whose story we aired a few years ago. At that time, there was a drought in Honduras. That's still happening today. And New Orleans had been inundated with rain, just as it was earlier this summer. Julia Kumari-Drapkin brought us this story.
Noel and Alcaldia Martinez are two brothers in a family of 15. The brothers are close. They talk on the phone almost every day. And lately, there's a conversation they've been having over and over again. They're talking about whether it's better to leave or better to stay in their home country of Honduras. So far, they've made opposite choices. Alcaldio stayed, Noel left. Let's start with Noel's side of all of this. I first met Noel here in New Orleans, at work in a basement apartment in Broadmoor, a neighborhood that some thought better to abandon after Hurricane Katrina. He and three other men are working on a day when most people went home early because of flooding. A river of moisture from Central America that meteorologists nicknamed the Mayan Express has been hosing down New Orleans with rain.
Por el trabajo, no hay mucho trabajo.
But Noel tells me, back in Honduras, there hasn't been enough work because there hasn't been enough rain for a long time.
No hay lluvia. No hay lluvia.
Noel and his family are from a tiny town in the central Honduran state of Yoro, surrounded by big pine tree forests. And every year, people there wait for the May rains to plant their fields and feed their animals. And when the rains do come to Yoro, people say it rains so hard, it rains fish. They post cell phone videos online to try and prove it really happens. Like this one from 2012, with children celebrating in the bright red mud with tiny fish in their hands on the side of the road. But for the past 4 years and counting, it's been abnormally dry. And not just in Noelle's hometown. Across Central America, less rain has been falling later. And it's been hot. Temperature records keep breaking. That's made it hard for farmers like Noelle. Staple crops like corn and beans and exports like coffee and bananas have been failing from fungus, pests, and drought. The pattern is precisely what climate change models predict for the region as global temperatures rise. When Noelle lost his bean crop, he couldn't find work that paid enough in any Honduran cities. So he made a decision. He'd cross the border. Come to the U.S. You probably heard a lot about Central American migrants, families moving in record numbers. And you probably also heard people say they are refugees from violence. And they are. But violence and the drought that brought Noelle north, they're connected. Because droughts put so many people out of work, research tells us climate change undermines security. Desperate people turn to crime, turn on each other, turn to other countries. Beneath it all, climate is an invisible, constant force. As Noelle crossed the border, the rest of his family stayed. The brother I mentioned at the beginning, Alcaldio, he stayed because he had a job. He was a milkman at a dairy, a job that was supposed to be more stable from one season to the next, unlike farming. But things were tough. Another brother, who also stayed, was murdered.
He was a farmer, and they just stole what he had on him and killed him. All of this leads people to crime, I don't know, as a way to make easy money.
Noel got the news when he was still crossing the border. He wanted to go home for the funeral, but his family told him to keep going. Both the drought and the violence back home were getting worse. Noel calls his brother almost every night from his work sites here in New Orleans. They talk, but sometimes it seems like they're talking right past each other. Now that Noel is here in the U.S. and Alcaldio is there in Honduras, each yearns for what the other brother has. They wish they could switch places. Noel's been here 2.5 years now, working for a better life. But now, more than anything, he wants to return home. Noel renovates empty houses for 12, sometimes 14 hours. Days are long and lonely. He hasn't seen his 5 children or his wife since he got in the car and left them behind 3 years ago.
You don't know if you're ever going to see them again. It's very hard.
Noel pulls out his cell phone. With a paint-encrusted finger, he plays voicemails from his youngest daughters, ages 3 and 8. They heard that Dad hurt his hand on a drill, so they tell him to come home so they can heal him. But you really don't need to speak Spanish to understand what they're saying. Noel doesn't want to live like this, raising his family with a cell phone. He has plans to go back someday, but it's hard to make the leap now that everyone's dependent on the money he's making here. This is what Noel keeps telling his brother. Supporting the family here means risking never seeing them again there. But despite hearing all of this, the loneliness, the dusk to dawn work, how much Noel misses home life in Honduras, Alcaldio insists he still wants to come.
He keeps telling me, you're no longer here, so I'm leaving too. But it's something you have to think hard about. I tell him he's crazy for wanting to come here.
Alcaldio isn't just missing his brother. Last year, the dairy where Alcaldio was working fired everybody. Without rain, there's no pasture. The cows were starving, so they sold them all for meat. By April, the only work Alcaldio could find was guarding wood in the lumber yards, a job created by extreme heat. It caused southern bark beetle populations to explode. They devoured the pine tree forests across Honduras. The only way to stop it is to cut down the trees, use them for lumber. They even called in the army to help. Now, guarding beetle-infested lumber every night for work makes Alcaldio anxious. But Noel is urging him to be patient.
I told him, you wait. I'm going to see how things are.
The last week in April, I called Alcaldio myself to see how he was doing. and I honestly expected to hear it was all terrible.
Ah, hola!
But just minutes before, Alcaldio told me it rained. Nobody in town was expecting it.
We looked at each other in shock. We looked at the sky and we couldn't guess rain was coming. And suddenly the rain fell hard. Hard for about 10 minutes nonstop. The land got wet and we got happy because it calmed the dust. It cleared the smoke in the air. The animals that were sad from thirst and heat got happy as well. Horses, cows, pigs, lambs.
Happy animals, happy people. Awesome, right? I asked Alcaldio, so now what? How does the rain change the situation? While the rain might have changed Alcaldio's job prospects, it still hasn't changed Alcaldio's desire to come to the U.S. That lumber he was guarding, it came from pine trees that are actually pretty essential to the longer-term rain patterns. Now that they're gone, thanks to the beetles, thanks to extreme heat, Alcaldio worries his hometown is becoming a desert.
We are rationing water. 2 hours in the morning, 2 in the afternoon. It's not enough to fill the water tanks. In the desert, there are no trees. Everything is barren. There is no shadow, no animals. It's all barren. No deer, no snakes, no other animals. It is like nature is no longer there. It is destroyed.
And right there, I realize that Alcaldio, just like a scientist would have, has laid out for me the difference between today's weather and tomorrow's climate. Today's single storm, this one season's sigh of relief, can't erase the longer-term risks of living in an unstable climate. Back in New Orleans, Noel still dreams about returning to Honduras. In 7 years, he says, he plans to buy a house again. But his wife thinks he'll never come back. Still, Noel works hard to stay connected. When the kids don't want to talk, he sends videos of the storms in New Orleans.
I sent them a video showing them, look how much it's raining. And my wife says, here, we can't even bear this heat anymore. We're burning.
There's the illusion that a right choice can be made here. One that will make the two brothers happy, make their family happy. But as they eye each other across the border, as much as they can see all the ways the other one got it right, they can also see all the ways the other one got it wrong. Any choice comes with a cost. Floods one place, drought another. Loneliness here, poverty there. As the climate changes, the conversation goes on. Two brothers making choices that are really no choice at all. For WBEZ, I'm Julia Kamari Drapkin.
That story was produced in 2016 in collaboration with WBEZ Chicago's Heat of the Moment series and Icy Change, a community climate and weather journal. There are a lot more stories about climate change at our website, including what we're expecting from global warming in our region. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schuman Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth.